Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Greetings from the summer solstice, Jeff.
On today's show, we conclude our deep bench series, and I claim to have a brilliant idea. But first, Houston was a problem. The Mets lost both games to the Astros and have now lost 3 out of 4. Plus, the injuries never seem to end. How are you feeling, Greg?
Well, my lower back feels okay, so that puts me one step ahead of Carlos Carrasco. Otherwise, I feel okay. Houston, 2-game series, lost them both. We lost some games in Houston in 1969 when 0-6 in the Astrodome. We lost some games in Houston in 1986, went 2-4, including the last 3 in the regular season amid the infamous Cooters incident. And then there was at least 1 loss in the postseason. And those teams came out okay. I think this team will come out okay. I think we've probably forgotten what it's like to lose an aggravating game, because the Mets losses, as few as there have kind of been in that, well, what are you going to do? It was just one of those nights. They didn't have it together. The other team was doing well. And that was what the first loss in Houston was like, and you could kind of shrug it off. The second loss was one of those, so close. And you kind of forgot that, oh, it's been a good season. It's just a bad day. And I think that's what it came down to. It was a bad day.
I sensed some frustration, not just from me, but from the team, more importantly, as the game went on. Escobar slamming his bat down. They were rightfully upset with the umpire. Maybe the day off will help them.
Yeah, they're not used to losing close games, like I said, and it should bother them. I don't mean they should go around with their head hung low and feel ashamed of themselves. I just mean, hey, they are used to winning. They are a team that is been in first place all year long. And by the way, it's still in first place by a whole bunch of games. So I think they expected to complete a comeback. It was the kind of game that felt like it was going to completely get away, especially once Carrasco left. The bullpen, including some people who haven't really been called on to do a whole lot, did a great job. But the Houston bullpen also did a great job. The Houston ball club is a very good club. They're in first place, too. Sometimes the ball doesn't bounce your way. I think, you know, the guys who probably had the most reason to look disgusted are going to come out of it. I think Eduardo Escobar is going to come out of it. He had a home run the night before. Marcano was kind of robbed on a call, quite frankly. You know, we might have benefited from a close call that helped Joely Rodriguez get out of a jam as well. So these things happen. 1-1 would have been better than 0-2. Go to Miami, win there.
Escobar with some classy comments after the game, saying, "I'll give the fans reasons to cheer for me," but he knows that he's not been playing up to his standards. I thought that was classy on his part.
Well, you know, if you're a professional baseball player and you've had a lousy game, you stand there, you answer the questions, you say it honestly, and you say it with some perspective. I think Eduardo Escobar has been around long enough to offer that kind of perspective. I wouldn't expect anything less.
When Carrasco left the game, Gary talked about looking outside the organization for getting new starting pitching. Some people on Twitter cried out, "Get to work, Billy." It's not that easy.
I'm sure they're going to look around. I bet they've been looking around the whole time. What do you think general managers do throughout the season? They just wait for an injury? I seriously doubt it. If Carrasco is out, that's a problem. We are fortunate that there's a day off between Houston and Miami. 3 games in Miami, another day off. 2 games back at home against Houston, another day off. So the rotation could give them problems right now, but I don't think it will, because they are able to skip some slots. And we also know that in the offing, if not immediately, then very soon, knock wood, Max Scherzer will be back. 1 minor league rehab start in the books. He's raring to go. We'll see if that's the wise course of action. But unless there's a horrible setback, he's back pretty soon, if not amazingly soon. And suddenly the rotation doesn't look to be as troubled if you have Max Scherzer back, and we won't even bring Jacob deGrom into this just yet. So, again, the fact that it was a lower back, not, oh, my arm, anything like that, is I'm right now taking a handkerchief to my forehead and dabbing the beads of sweat off because I'm not that worried, because I'm relieved that it's only his lower back. Let's hope that that doesn't lead to something else, but I'm just not ready to end it all after losing two games in Houston.
I'm sure that Max enjoyed the carousels of Binghamton and noted that it's on the way from New York to Cooperstown, but he's undoubtedly ready to pitch and is probably telling Buck, get me in the rotation on Sunday.
No doubt. It's what he's here for. That's how he sees his job. That's how we see his job. You just don't want to rush him too soon. I could live on the cautious side of waiting one more start if necessary. But if he's ready to go, feeling good after a couple of days following the start in Binghamton, welcome back, Max.
I agree with you on that. Just because there may be a hole in the rotation doesn't mean Scherzer's timing should be rushed. I did want to ask you, Greg, have you voted for the All-Stars? In case you haven't heard from the plethora of emails and all the announcements, it's All-Star voting time. Have you voted?
I have not voted yet. I am waiting for the Mets to send at least three players to my door, preferably with some sort of enticement to get me to vote for them. I'll get around to it. You know, this is a good feeling, because I think last year was the first year of my life in which I had access to an All-Star ballot, and it's all been online for years, where I just didn't bother voting, which makes me sound like a bad citizen of baseball. I remember being so discouraged by the fact there was no Met I wanted to vote for by the time this time of year rolled around, because the guys I would have voted for, the Mets I would have voted for, were either injured or slumping. And I said, I can never just do that. Vote for your favorite Mets. If I have like a scintilla of a reason to do it, I will throw my support. And at some point, 2020, 2021, it just didn't feel like a festive occasion.
Are you saying that you want them to come to your door with a flyer like they're running for city councilman?
Hi, my name is Jeff McNeil, and I'd like to tell you about my platform for starting at second base in the All-Star game. If you send me to Los Angeles, I promise to bring spit and vinegar and run hard to the All-Star game. In fact, I will run literally to the All-Star game, assuming my hamstring's okay. Yeah, that's what I need to hear.
People are saying which Mets should make the first cut. I guess there's a phase one, a phase two, which Mets deserve to make it. I've come to a decision on this, Greg. The entire Mets team should be the National League team, except for the catchers. I don't want to be ridiculous.
No, don't be ridiculous, for God's sake.
Moving on.
What are you, John Oliver?
I wish. Baseball is good at a lot of things and not so good at a lot of things. From time to time, I want to tell you about ideas I've had. Until now, only Greg and my disinterested wife have heard these. But with NLT, I can share them with you. It's up to you if you're disinterested too. This segment is called Jeff's Brilliant Ideas. There used to be a time when a national holiday meant doubleheaders. Obviously. They play doubleheaders on national holidays because most everyone is off from work and school, so people have more leisure time to follow baseball. But then the owners realized that two games in one day meant only one gate. And since the players didn't like them, no one minded when scheduled doubleheaders were done away with. No one asked the fans, but you knew that. Instead, MLB treats national holidays as just another day on the schedule. This year, six teams didn't play on Memorial Day, and that's absurd. It's time to create events on the schedule, rather than one day just leading to the next. Days that fans will circle and look forward to. And one way is for every team to play a doubleheader on national holidays: Memorial Day, July 4th, and Labor Day. In fact, add a fourth for Juneteenth, which is also a national holiday. 30 games in one day. Spread out the start times, and we'll have baseball all day long. The owners will hate it. Too bad. The players will hate it. Too bad. Sometimes you have to give something back to the game instead of just taking and taking, especially after depriving us of a proper off-season and spring training. The fans will love it, and that should count at least once in a while. Think of the buzz across the country as every team plays a doubleheader. Pete did what? Did you see what Ohtani did? So much is going on. Isn't it great? It will be. A full day with 30 games, four times a season. Let's do it.
I'd be curious to see how this would go over, if they would at least try it. Pick one of the holidays. Pick Labor Day, maybe. The 4th of July, as everybody knows, is for the watching of 1776, at least for me. But, again, this used to be par for the course, to borrow from another sport. I'd be interested to see if today's attention spans could handle the idea of two games at once scheduled, not just, oh my God, we have to get these out of the way because it rained yesterday. But I'd really like to see, to be honest, is Banner Day doubleheader come back. You may remember the Mets brought back Banner Day on a real small scale about 10 years ago, kept it for a few years, did it at what felt like 8 a.m. It was a little later than that. And it didn't have that same snap to it, maybe because we'd all been out of practice. They hadn't done it since the mid-90s. Maybe they hadn't promoted it enough. Maybe people just don't want to do those things that we cherish anymore. But I thought the reason Banner Day worked so well in its heyday was because you had a doubleheader. And you finish one game and you look forward to that parade, and then you got on with the second one. I don't know if I'm all in on four scheduled holiday doubleheaders. Hey, America, drop what you're doing. What I would like to see is try it once, get some momentum for it, add another one, get America wanting that second holiday doubleheader. Yeah, I'll even watch 1776 on the 5th of July if I have to. You'll have to mess around with the schedule, perhaps. If you have Sunday doubleheaders, you'll have to give these guys Monday off. But I like the idea. I like the idea that baseball takes its rightful place as the national pastime and does something proactive to bring people in other than wearing ugly caps and off-color jerseys. I don't mean off-color, not safe for work. Just those aren't the team colors. I don't want to go down the road of grumpy old fanism any further. So I'll stop there. But I applaud the idea. I applaud the spirit behind it. And yeah, I think I would find the appetite eventually for two games every day and a 324-game season, if possible.
What do you think of Jeff's first brilliant idea? Let us know. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and nationalleaguetown@gmail.com. What do you think of that idea? Everybody plays a doubleheader on national holidays. Well, we continue with National League Town. All good things must come to an end, and we're up to the final segment of our epic deep bench series on the Mets' best utility player of each decade, a series so good that Ken Burns said, "Why didn't I think of that?" And this means that we are now where we are now, the 2020s. So far, the award has gone to, and here's the roll call, for the 60s, Hot Rod Caneal, for the 70s, Teddy Martinez, for the 80s, Bob Baylor, for the 90s, Melvin Mora, for the 2000s, Joe McEwing, for the 2010s, Justin Turner. Who will it be for the 2020s? I think you have a guess. Greg will also talk about a few other Mets that came through in supporting roles. And now, it's back to the present as we look at the 2020s.
The current decade, from neither a chronological nor baseball standpoint, is a quarter done. But there's no time like the present. So let's celebrate the present a little bit. You don't have to be a Mets fan to acknowledge the 2020s have been strange times. Putting aside the world at large, We've had an extremely short season, dubious rules changes, and a whole new segment of the injured list set aside for players who test positive for a virus we never heard of at the end of the 2010s. Because COVID can, like a light-hitting backup catcher, pop up without warning, a deep bench may be more important than ever. The Mets pushed their bench front and center when they were playing their best in 2021. When injuries of all sorts failed their regulars, the bench transcended utility and became essential. Or have you already forgotten the bench mob, that collection of reserves who kept the season from going awry, at least for a while? Before we move on to the present, let's salute a few of the names who got us through the fleeting recent past. On a pound-for-pound basis, these so-called bench guys elevated the Mets more in 2021 than those they replaced. Kevin Pillar, Jonathan Villar, Jose Peraza, and right in the wheelhouse of the kind of player we've loved to toast in this series, Brandon Drury. Drury was a journeyman utility man who came to the Mets a year ago and caught absolute fire, playing first, second, third, left, and right, and when not plugging holes in the field, pinch hitting like a latter-day Rusty Staub, albeit from the right side. Brandon hit 367 when called upon by manager Luis Rojas, kind of a backup manager himself if you think about it, to bat for somebody else. Drury connected for four hits and four consecutive pinch hitting appearances in late July, earning a start in right field on the last night of the month. All he did then was deliver the winning hit in the 10th inning, keeping the Mets comfortably in first place and having me believe for about 10 minutes there'd be no stopping them. August came and the club's momentum faded, but let's not forget all Brandon Drury and his mob mates did while he was here. I think it's appropriate the last game in which we saw him play for the Mets finished on August 31st, yet it's in the books as having taken place on April 11th, which you might recall started in the rain, got suspended in the first inning, and was picked up after having barely begun. I told you the rules had been dubious. That was also the game that followed on the heels of the whole thumbs-down controversy when the Mets won on Michael Conforto driving home Javi Baez with the fifth run of the ninth inning, and because it hadn't been bizarre enough at Citi Field that day, Baez's expensive earring came loose and everybody crawled around home plate to see if they could find it. Never a dull moment with these Mets in the 2020s. The odd part, where Brandon Drury is concerned, is he made his Met debut on May 21st. Yet according to Baseball Reference, he played for us a month earlier. Never mind that he was nowhere in sight on April 11th. Anyway, the Mets had to shuffle players around the roster, and August 31st / April 11th turned out to be Drury's Mets swan song. You got to be pretty versatile to be in 2 months at once, especially when you weren't in one of them at all. Drury, like so many members of the briefly revered bench mob, were here and gone in 2021. But one of that crew's foundational pieces preceded most of them on the Mets and is still here. He was here in the latter stages of the 2010s, and from the looks of his performance in 2022, he's not going anywhere soon. I can't tell you with a shred of certainty who we'd be talking about as the utility Met of the 2020s if we were doing this when the decade was over, but I swear I wouldn't be surprised if the man then is the man now. The man now is Luis Guillorme. In this age, when so many big box office movies emanate from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it may be appropriate that Louis is our superheroic super sub of the moment. He first grabbed our attention when he calmly grabbed a flying bat out of the air as it hurtled into the Mets dugout in spring training, averting potential catastrophe. He once stared down an opposing pitcher, Jordan Hicks, for more than 15 minutes through a 22-pitch plate appearance, and he worked out a walk. Again, it was spring training, but we all saw it, even if we didn't necessarily believe it. He is outfitted in orange and blue, a mild-mannered uniform compared to those sported by the Avengers, but he doesn't require a whole lot of padding. In spring training, after he handled a tough hop one day, Bug Showalter told SNY's John Harper, "I caught up with him when he came off the field and I asked, 'Do you wear a cup?' He held up his hands and smiled. 'This is my cup.' Try writing dialogue like that, Marvel. For that matter, try coming up with a cooler nickname than Luis's. Los Manos, the hands. That would fit in neatly with Iron Man and Ant-Man, and as 2022 has progressed, transcends our notion of utility man. Seems all our best anecdotes for Luis Guillorme have risen from Port St. Lucie. Maybe that was just practice for what he's been giving us on the major league level this year. After making intermittent impressions ever since his first promotion from the minors in 2018, Luis has established himself as a major league fixture this year. Maybe it took Showalter to recognize the defensive genius on his hands, or in Luis's hands. Suddenly, Guillaume isn't the afterthought he used to be. If he's not playing second, he's playing third, unless he's playing a little short. He's doing all of it intelligently and athletically, getting to almost everything and finding ways to get rid of every ball he touches so it finds a fellow fielder and records a necessary out. Fella's also hitting like never before. Early in the season, it seemed novel that Guillaume would blast a ball to deep center. Francisco Lindor chuckled that he thought it might go out until he remembered it was little Louis who hit it. Since then, Luis has been hitting like he's been playing, regularly and with elan. It's no longer surprising to find him in the lineup or on base. And with Buck Showalter making moves, it's not a shock to see his utility put to better use than ever. This regime has tapped into the potential Jeff McNeil showed in 2019, with the squirrel shifting comfortably between the infield and the outfield while batting over 300 again. This regime was making optimal use of a so-called spare part like Travis Jankowski, who, before hurting his hand, was on his way to setting pinch running records as a Met. And this regime has made you forget how dull baseball can be with the designated hitter, a universal fact of life. Buck is still strategizing, never mind that he hardly ever has to double switch. Our manager also seems to have touched off an industry-wide debate on whether a super sub deserves a spot on the All-Star team when he nominated his own superb sub. Even if Luis is more a regular irregular than substitute of late, there should be a category in the All-Star game, for lack of a better expression, for a utility player, Buck said recently. You can't win without one. There should be a column for those guys. They should get recognized, kind of like Guillaume. They're very valuable. I've always wondered why they haven't had one. Suddenly, we're wondering why we've had Luis Guillaume all this time and only this year have come to fully embrace and appreciate him. Maybe it has something to do with who's managing him. Maybe it's simply a matter of the right player earning the right amount of time. I also wonder why a football can name special teams players to the Pro Bowl as a matter of course. How is it baseball only now is figuring out it has something essential in its utility man? It's been a fun season full of fun games, and it's because the Mets are finding a way for all their players to succeed. Surely this is the team of Alonso and Lindor and Nimmo and Marte and Diaz and, when they're healthy, Scherzer and, of course, DeGrom. But when you sit down and watch every day and night, you are reminded that this is also the team of Luis Guillaume, the glue of the infield, the heart of the order wherever he happens to be batting, proprietor of the best beard in New York sports, especially since James Harden skedaddled out of Brooklyn. And until or unless we learn something different over the next 75% of the 2020s, our final utility man of the decade across this series we've called Deep Bench. As usual, I've talked a lot. But let me ask you for your thoughts, Jeff. After 7 episodes of talking about these role players, beyond the fun history part I hope we've shared, has anything about the way you view so-called utility men changed? And for that matter, what do you make of our man of the hour, Luis Guillaume?
It's not a surprise when Luis Guillaume is in the lineup. I think with the players who we feeded when the series started, if they were in the lineup, you thought something was wrong, or it was the second game of a doubleheader. Now, it's not a surprise when Guillaume is in, and I think that's a product of our times. In the old days, there used to be 10 pitchers, and you had 15 hitters. Now, 13 pitchers. So you have 3 or 4 guys on the bench, so you need multi-position players, which makes Luis Guillaume and others of his ilk even more important in the 2020s than when we started this series.
I think we both come to believe Buck Showalter has reinvented Mets baseball. You know, reinvented, because as we each know, the modern game was invented by Bobby Valentine, of course. I think this moment of versatility and uber utility has been coming for a while. In 2011, I was privileged to join a bloggers conference call with Paul DePodesta, then one of Sandy Alderson's assistant GMs and a former GM in his own right. When my turn to ask him a question came up, perhaps subconsciously anticipating I'd be doing a podcast on this very topic someday, I wanted to know how versatility factored into player development. Here's what DePodesta offered by way of response. The reality is a lot of players, maybe most players, when they first get to the big leagues, are in a role that they are unaccustomed to, or at least largely unaccustomed to. They get there as a bench player. They get there as a utility player. Maybe they get there as a long guy, even though they've been a starting pitcher their entire career. So one of the things we need to try to do in our player development system is to prepare guys for that. It makes them more attractive and more versatile for us. because they have a better chance of actually helping us at the major league level, but also putting them in a position so it's not the first time they've ever had to deal with playing different spots or experiencing different things. Most middle infielders, when they first get to the big leagues, they have to be able to play some shortstop. They have to be able to be a utility guy first. And it certainly gives them a lot of value to a club and gives them a much better chance of breaking with a team if they can go and play shortstop for 15 days at a time. So this has been in the Mets' bloodstream for a while, and I think we saw its efficacy hinted at throughout the 2010s, where you had Daniel Murphy starting at second mostly, but first and third occasionally, even if he wasn't a classic utility man, and he was too important a bat to consider as a bench guy and not enough of a glove to send back to the outfield. We saw it to a degree with Wilmer Flores, who got reps all over the infield, although again, that was about Wilmer's bat more than it was his glove. Perhaps a Met team that had re-signed Jose Reyes while letting Murphy settle in at second could have made better use of Ruben Tejada, who might have been overmatched as an everyday shortstop, but showed signs of being versatile in the best sense of the word when he first broke in. Remember, the Mets made a big push to sign Ben Zobrist, the quintessential Swiss Army knife of the 2010s, when he was a free agent before Zobrist opted to go to the Cubs. He was more or less McNeil before there was a McNeil. For that matter, you go back to the Bobby Valentine days, and we had Edgardo Alfonso, who was, in a way, the ultimate can-play-anywhere infielder, came up as a shortstop, saw Ray Ordonez was going to block his path, turned himself into an elite starting third baseman, switched to second to make room for Robin Ventura, who was a gold glover in his own right, was even better at second than he had been at third, and then shifted back to third to make room for Roberto Alomar. You would have missed a lot not having Fonzie as a rock in that lineup, but I have to imagine that if he came along today, we'd see Fonzie still get his reps, but move around more than he did once he became established. Before we leave the deep bench, I want to enter into the record two passages that ostensibly have nothing to do with the Mets, yet everything to do with what we've been discussing. The first dates back to 1954, specifically the first game of that year's World Series between the New York Giants and the Cleveland Indians. We recognize that game now for Willie Mays' catch off Vic Wertz and the throw that followed. But what makes that game extra special to baseball fans who like to read was it was the subject of a day in the bleachers, Arnold Hano's gem of a book about what it was like to sit at the Polo Grounds and watch history unfold before anybody knew it was history. If, as some have suggested, Roger Angel was essentially the first baseball blogger, Arnold Hano with this book wrote the first extended blog post. Please read it if you haven't. Within a day in the bleachers, Hano noted the following after Cleveland manager Al Lopez had pulled out all the stops to beat the Giants, only to find himself tied in extra innings. In the Giant 10th, he wrote, the Indians were down to a substitute first baseman, a substitute shortstop, a substitute right fielder, and a substitute catcher. The implication was Cleveland did not have a deep enough bench and was about to be overmatched. And sure enough, the Giants won in the 10th inning on Dusty Rhodes' pinch-hit home run and would go on to sweep the Indians, who were thought to be much stronger, yet they weren't deeper. The other passage, which I came across just the other week, is from the world of hockey, a retrospective on the Islanders dynasty, a subject close to my Long Island heart, but that's neither here nor there. What got me when I read this article by Joe Smith in The Athletic, comparing those Islanders to the current Tampa Bay Lightning, was this quote from Bob Bourne, center on those Islander Stanley Cup teams. To me, your best players have to be your best players, and they will always have to be. But the biggest thing with the teams that win championships is the third and fourth line guys. And I hate that term, but on our team, you could take guys off our bottom six and put them into the top six, and they'd be a good player. Stanley Cups aren't won without those lines. NBA titles aren't won without the sixth man. Super Bowls aren't won without very special teams. And yes, the World Series often comes down to pinch hitter J.C. Martin putting his bat on the ball and sending pinch runner Rod Gaspar home from second. Or platoon player Al Weiss slugging. Or Kevin Mitchell getting off the phone, allegedly, and coming out to face Calvin Schiraldi. And games and seasons are defined by who you weren't expecting to come through and those you learned you could depend on, if not every day, then on many days. We've had some fun with this topic. We brought some names out of the annals and back into conversation, but I hope we've shown and learned ourselves that you have to take everybody and every role into account when you're building a champion. I don't know if that's where we're headed in 2022, but I have more confidence in the entire unit based on watching how they're deployed and how they're executing than I might have before this season began. So yes, Here's to our deep bench. From Hot Rod to Los Manos and beyond.
One thing I want to reserve, Greg, is if we're still doing this at this decade's end, and who knows what format podcasts will be in 2030, you can revisit Luis's title.
I wonder if Luis will, like Edgardo Alfonso, who I might have talked up circa 1996, will be saying, what do you mean, utility guy? Luis Guillorme has won 4 MVPs for the dynastic Mets. Or we'll say, hey, how about that guy who came along after Guillorme? He was quite an improvement, wasn't he, for the 5-time world champion Mets. If we're going to be visionaries here, let's envision nothing but the best for our team.
Absolutely. What other aspect of utility players, as they are presently used, and this comes from Baseball Prospectus, a column by Russell Carlton a few weeks ago called The Rest Won't Take Care of Itself. As multi-positionality has become a force in the game, teams have used this as a way to get their regulars a breather. Despite there being few players on the bench now, starters get less playing time. So you need someone who can play second, short, third, outfield, more than ever, because you want your starters to rest, and you want somebody to come off the bench and who you can plug in at second, third, short, outfield. So multi-positionality is more important than ever, making the utility player what Joel Sherman, and I'm not in the habit of plugging the New York Post, call a multi-position weapon. He said in a column this week, as organizations value the super utility man, or what I will term the sum, because the sum of the parts at which that one player performs resonates in value, he argues for a separate position on the All-Star team for the sum, a super utility man. So what we started talking about, the player has become more important than ever.
This almost mirrors the development of relief pitching 50 or so years ago. I mean, there was a time where it was controversial for managers to pick relief pitchers to go to the All-Star game, unless it was an absolute great relief pitcher, because starting pitchers, come on, that's what it's all about. Maybe it's finally catching up with the so-called utility players, super utility players. You were talking about multi-positionality. What that article was talking about is an excellent point. Because they play every day. They don't play doubleheaders. Nobody would get rest. I mean, I always laugh when they talk about a player. Oh, here's what his statistics would be over 162 games. Oh, do they have anybody who could catch? You know, 140 games. They have somebody who can play short, 150 games. You hardly see anybody play those numbers of games anymore. So you have to have this kind of depth that we've been talking about. And you have to have trust in those guys. But if I can rewind the conversation back to our very first episode in the series, Gil Hodges cultivated this sort of thing with his team. Nobody was considered just a spare part, an extra guy. He got everybody in regularly. He found ways for them not just to play, but to succeed. And you could never count the Mets out, as Earl Weaver learned, as Leo DeRocher, who was playing his guys into the ground, learned, because everybody was ready to go. And it's apparently something that's ebbed and flowed over the years. And, you know, as I was talking about with Paul DePodesta, it's something that's been on the mind of baseball decision makers for a while, but it's taken a while, I think, for it to take hold. Making it policy almost, making it philosophy, I think, is the new part here. And it's fascinating to watch it unfold close to us. And it's gratifying to know the Mets seem to be on the leading edge of this, at least, you know, this phase of the development of what we will, for convenience sake, still call the utility player.
Congratulations to Luis Guillorme and all the other honorees. We hope you enjoyed the Deep Bench series.
Hey, do these guys get anything? You keep congratulating them, and we're giving them awards.
They are welcome to be a guest on the NLT podcast at any time.
Teddy Martinez, Bob Baylor, you heard the man. Give us a call.
As long as it fits within our schedule.
Yeah, you know, we can't just make room for anybody.
If there's a Mets game on, we're not doing it.
No, but I'm sure that everybody who's ever played for the Mets feels the same way.
And that'll do it for another episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week with more. I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2022, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Bandcamp.